completion of Reform creeds, then English Reformation.
An admission to the Reform creed, which of course is common in Catholicism, that besides being justified, you can become, as it were, more and more justified. Another word for that, becoming more and more justified, is sanctification. Yet even that, no less than justification, is all and entirely the work of God, even though its manifestation will be in the good works that you perform. Yes, Mike.
Yeah. Well, if you don't do anything to, you don't do anything yourself to contribute to this justification, what then is the reason, so it's not just lost in the mind of God, for increased justification, sanctification, and so on?
Well, the same as for justification, to glorify God. You become more and more conscious of your weakness and incapacity, and that you see not only that you have become justified at all, but you're becoming more justified through God's mercy.
So it's just an arbitrary thing in God's part.
Arbitrary? Calvin wouldn't like the word arbitrary. God decides it, and it's his affair. He is God, after all. Clay, say to the potter, why do you shape me thus? Well, if by arbitrary you mean that it's just a whim, well, it's not a whim. The plan is really. Well, you might say, as Calvin did, nobody had anything to say about coming into the world. Slightly arbitrary. And once you come into the world, it's perhaps a whim on our part to think that we're supposed to, just because we're in the world, supposed to enjoy ourselves. Maybe some have come into the world in order to suffer. Who are we to say, since we have nothing to do about coming into the world at all, that we're supposed to just enjoy ourselves? And if the suffering is not only in this life, but also in the next, and as Calvin says, the tragedies of this life are only a foretaste of the next. As the joys of heaven, so the pains of hell. I mean, the one is being tragic to the other. We don't like to suffer. It's life. After death, people don't like to go to hell. And that's life.
Clarification in terms here. Our last meeting, the term justification and regeneration were used synonymously. Now it's used synonymously with sanctification. Is this theological?
Yes, not quite. It's really, there are no two perfect synonyms in any language, as you probably know. That's a misnomer. There's always an approximation. There's some new aspect, see, or light thrown on the concept. So if justification is generic, when the concern is over the change which takes place, that is regeneration. When it is simply the fact, well, that's just plain justification. When you think in terms of its degrees, that is sanctification. And there are others we could build up. Not merit. Now see, the trouble with this is that you're dealing with ultimates here, ultimates of human psychology and really of metaphysics. After all, this has been 4 centuries in process of development, and even the creed that we're handling was 100 years old from the Reformation. And the men who first framed the theology, men like Calvin and subsequent theologians, were not dumb. Okay? This is not, you might say, a hodgepodge. This is carefully knit. And consequently, when we say that there is no contribution on the part of man like merit, the answer is true. There isn't. If, however, you say that in the process of justification, man contributes nothing, that is not true, because he does. The point is that whatever contribution is made, it is not contribution in that, and only in that sense, which of course is an important sense, in that sense of there being an intrinsic, now that's the only word you can use accurately. Internal isn't even strong enough. There is no built-in, intrinsic, naked power which belongs to you as you, so that it depends upon you to use or not use the grace that God gives. Now, provided you hold that, provided you say that there is no such native power, especially of human will, which contributes its part in such a way that the grace can come and, watch this, be ineffectual in the purpose intended by God. Once you say that, if you say that that purpose can be frustrated in any way by a preacher, you have ceased to be a Calvinist. You're outside the ambit of Reformed theology. But if you say that it's God's grace and uses human powers, so that in a way you are contributing, but the contribution is really God's using you and producing good works and virtues and all the rest.
What does your
art mean? Oh, what does it mean? Oh, that means that's regeneration. Okay.
Then where does the individual's free will come in?
He doesn't have it. He doesn't have a free will which can respond to grace in such a way as either to cooperate or to resist that grace. Never. Now let's just make sure we don't miss this, because if you miss this, really, you have just simply not got the, pardon me for putting it this way. Well, look, under free will, chapter 9, of free will, and paragraph 3 is the crucial one. Man by his fall into a state of sin. Which state are we talking about? Adam's sin. This may be ambiguous. It's the sin of Adam. Half holy. It isn't only when we sin that's subsequent to Adam's sin. Man by his fall into a state of sin, which man is concerned here? All mankind, the human race, have wholly lost, language couldn't be stronger, all ability of will to do any spiritual good accompanying salvation. So as a natural man, being altogether averse from that good and dead in sin, is not able by his own strength to convert himself, to prepare himself, thereof too. Then, in page 201 under chapter 6, which is a corollary to that later concept, by this sin, the sin of Adam, they fell, Adam and Eve, from their original righteousness and communion with God, and so became, as did our first parents, and we were, dead in sin, wholly defiled in all the faculties and parts of soul and body. And then from this original corruption, we are utterly indisposed, disabled, made opposite to all good, and wholly inclined to all evil. These are classic descriptions of total depravity. And so you ask to answer your question. You can will indeed, notice. It is not that you don't will. You will. You sure will. What do you will? All evil. If you will any good, if you will any good, you've got the subject of that sentence. It's God who then is willing good in you, through you, for you. You as you will only you.
Then God is performing by using that person acts which reflect his own glory than himself.
Yes.
Then isn't this a selfish connotation of God?
Well, no more selfish, I suppose Calvin would say, than in having those who reach heavenly glory. God gets a certain, thrill out of knowing people achieve heaven because he got them there. So those who get to hell, God, humanly speaking, will get a thrill out of the fact that these people were bad, and sure enough, they're being punished for their wickedness. But behind it all stands the unanswered question of Calvinism, which is, in chapter 6, paragraph 1, the verb permit. This their sin God was pleased, according to his wise and holy counsel, to permit. That word permit is Catholicism, embedded into a whole volume of Calvinism. Because the moment you say permit, you mean allow. You imply some other agency which is operating, which you permit to operate for another purpose. That's the Middle Ages. That's Aquinas. That's the Council of Trent.
Was this section taken from his institute?
Practically verbatim.
I tried from the afternoon class to quote this to Dr. Drumler, and I got a different explanation naturally. Right. But I got so confused by the time it was over. I just gave up.
Well, do you remember what explanation he did give?
I couldn't move through it. But I was wondering if you knew where in the institutes this was.
I would look in Book 3, Chapter 21, I think, is what I gave you. Chapter 21. Do you have any institutes here? Anybody have a copy of the institutes here? That would be wonderful. Anybody with the institutes? Ladies and gentlemen, you know, institutes.
That looks like a big book. What is that? Somebody else has mine. Yeah. Nobody has the institutes.
We
could
rent
mine.
We have to have
one of the. Well, we'll. One only. So chapter 3, I think it's 21. Not book 3, then. Book 3, chapter 21. Which, by the way, is deceptive. That chapter goes on. But it's somewhere in there. Then I would say, in other words, this book 3 in general deals with this area. And around chapters 19, 20, 21 is a relationship of freedom and grace. For Calvin is at great pains to defend God's justice, in his sense, in spite of his predestining somebody for him.
Most people, the person he talked to, was he likely to explain it the way Calvin did it?
Well, that's what I'm wondering, what he did. Now, by the way, since Dr. Grunder will do us the honors on Thursday, the 2nd of July, be sure, of course, to...
ask this question.
Yeah, just don't miss that, because we will be... I had, by the way, a Reformed minister in my class in this course, the 321 course. And remember what he told us, Dave? Dr. Buchheim?
Oh, last
year. Remember what he said? That
he said that they've gone away from most of them.
They have departed from Calvin, see? And that is the usual explanation. A departure from Calvin, from absolute predestination.
People don't glorify God. God glorifies himself.
Yes. Well, of course, in a way, it's the essence of all Christianity, because God, in making man, even though human beings glorify him, nevertheless, he was the one who made them, and therefore, in that sense, he is glorifying himself.
But when he endowed them with free will, they had the choice of either loving him or not. In this case, it is not simply a selfish return or reflection. It is
a loving,
a true,
response.
Sincere response.
That's it.
But still, the purpose behind it, the motive behind it, was about getting glory. I don't think you can deny the fact that God is an egocentric God. I'm not saying that this would be a condemnation in any sense of the word. It's just
egocentric. Egocentric, and that he wants to be glorified. Well, mm-hmm. Sure.
This is why it made man, whether with a free will or without.
Well, except he's not egocentric in this sense. See, egocentricity has a very bad connotation of somehow benefiting or profiting at somebody else's expense. And that's the antithesis of God. Because God in no way profits from anything that he gives anybody.
I'm speaking just self-love.
Yes.
Father, in actual... living out of this creed, did any of the Calvinists actually in their own lives really believe in the absence of free will? Because remember, wasn't it Jonathan Edwards from who wrote his treatise on the fact that there was no free will, but he was driven out of his pulpit even in early America when he tried to preach straight Calvinism.
Well, I suppose you can say that. A consistent, absolute predestination would, in its way, destroy religion as a practical way of life. Why exhort people to be good if they're going to be good or bad regardless? However, after saying that, we must admit, though, that you can live it out very far, inasmuch as man does have all kinds of weaknesses. He is subject to all kinds of sin, and it makes a huge difference whether, in the last analysis, I hold somebody or something outside of myself responsible, or I admit my own responsibility for what I do. And there's no doubt that in the Reformed tradition, there is, if you will, a saddling of responsibility on the part of God, which you don't find in other traditions. Plus, of course, the real reason, as I, well, it's so many things you assume have been pointed out, maybe haven't been, but the real historical reason for the Reformed theology coming into existence was the church. See, that was the scandal. That was the problem. It was this society, this organization, this priesthood, these sacraments, and all the myriad things that make up the complexes of the church, which on the one hand seemed, so it seemed to say men like Calvin and Luther, to have desperately failed, or despicably failed. In other words, if man is supposed to contribute something to the work of his salvation, well, let's see what he contributed. And if he could speak anachronistically, you'd have to have a microscope to see what man did, what man accomplished. See? There was so much immorality, so much vice, so much depravity, depending, of course, partly on the viewpoint too, as to make one question. See, Calvin did in his day what Pelagius did in his. Remember Pelagius' problem? See? Back in Pelagius' time, 4th century, early 5th, Pelagius was a monk, no less than Luther was. He went about, if he had walked less, traveled less, he probably wouldn't have seen so much. He went all over, in fact, he went to Rome, and that settled it. Of all places, he expected the highest sanctity to be found in Rome. He didn't find it. Well, frankly, he should have known. But he began to speculate, and seeing the immorality then rife, he attributed that immorality to an erroneous theology. Where's the error? The error was to saddle everything on God and not to exert yourself. No wonder people are bad. Look what they're saying. Wait for God. He's going to make you good. And if you're bad, blame God. It's not my affair. It's His. Let Him make me good. So Pelagius denied grace. Calvin, in a way, and the Reformers, especially Calvin, were faced with a like dilemma. They saw immorality all around them. Whatever else they saw, they did see the church insisting upon man's cooperation with grace, on the reception of the sacraments, on indulgences, on good works of all kinds, even to the extent of paying money. All very human, mercenary things even. Calvin took the opposite position. The trouble with the world, the Christian world, is its theology is wrong. No wonder it got that way. The mistake that was made was in believing that man can moralize himself, can sanctify himself. And then the other extreme was taken. Unless you see it this way, the thing just hasn't been touched. Calvin then found, as we know in Augustine, what he was looking for. It's not a coincidence that Calvin should have spent 1,100 years after all. Hundreds of people had written between Augustine and Calvin. The mean, M-I-G-N-E, not N-E-A-N, edition of the Fathers of the Church is over 400 volumes. They cover one whole room, and they're not little volumes either. They're not little paperbacks. Great big things. Calvin had all of that to go through, he wanted to support his claims. Where did he go? He went to the one man who was the best, you might say, source for his position, Augustine, who fought the very kind of principle, you might say, that Calvin was trying to fight. Pelagius claimed it was all man's will. The world was bad in Pelagius' time. The world was bad in Calvin's time. Both was concerned in improving the world. Pelagius said, undo the error of thinking that you need grace. Calvin said, undo the error of thinking that you can do anything. It's all grace. Yes, sister.
If Calvin is saying that it's all grace without man's cooperation, then how did the Council of Trent get around to emphasizing the exoperium morato value of sacrifices? What came in between? That's kind of a dumb question.
Well, no, it is not a dumb question. It's a good question. It's the same principle. In other words, the Council of Trent, consistent with theology for centuries before, insisted that there is a cooperation on the part of man. Now, the cooperation on the part of man in sacraments is twofold. It is first, receiving the sacrament. If you don't receive the sacrament, you don't receive baptism, you don't get the grace. Secondly, on the part of man, so in other words, man's, if that's what you're trying to say, right? No?
Today the council is saying that...
Today the council...
The council today says that the council of Trent emphasized ex operio operato so much that now we have to take a little bit different position. Well, if the council of Trent was talking against the position of Calvin, who said that man does not have to do anything, God does it all, then why was it necessary to put the emphasis on the ex operio operato?
Well, for two reasons. First of all, I want to qualify, in fact, to excavate your statement, sister. It is not true, pardon my saying it this way, the Second Vatican Council is nowhere saying, we'll never say, that Trent went too far in his position on the sacraments. There are those who are so saying. They will never be accepted by any council of the Catholic Church. There's a lot of free speech. That's part of it. But secondly, as far as the Council of Trent itself went, after all, along with the insistence upon grace, there really was such an insistence upon grace and grace alone doing the work, and therefore it is so completely and uniquely in God's hands, whether he gives one the grace or not, that you don't need the sacraments. And consequently, the first big thing which the Council of Trent had to do, so it felt, was to insist upon the necessity of the sacraments at all. Because baptism, as you know, in classic Protestantism, is not necessary for salvation. It's helpful, fine aid, but not essential. Well, once the necessity of the sacraments had been declared, then of course you've got to say, well now, what does the sacrament mean? How does it give grace? Now, although much of the mentality or the attitude behind Trent was to meet the challenge of the Reformation, it is not a polemic council. It wasn't just out, you might say, to unseat the reformers. It was out to declare what is the teaching of the Church. And part of that teaching is that grace is given in virtue of the sacrament, which is what ex operio operato means, and therefore even a child, before the age of reason, can receive the full efficacy of the sacraments. Now it still implies human cooperation, because it implies the sacrament must be received. You don't baptize the child, it doesn't get the grace. Nevertheless, grace is essential. In other words, the Council of Trent did not want to be outdone by the Reformation in its insistence upon the necessity of grace, or of God's love in giving grace. That's the towering motif. It's when you so isolate or insulate that concept as to remove completely all of man's cooperation that you then depart from traditional Catholicism. And in the same context, along with declaring that in order to receive grace from the sacraments, all you've got to do is receive the sacrament and place no obstacle in the way, he immediately added, even as far as baptism goes, which is not commonly known even by most Catholics, no two adults receive baptism with the same fruit. Even baptism gives a different amount of grace to two different people. We speculate as regarding children, because we hardly suspect there are different dispositions between, say, you and a set of twins when they're baptized. But once a person is an adult and is baptized, see, then the human element, as to the amount of grace, determines how much you get. And in fact, you see that ex opere operato, that you get the grace from the sacrament, is nevertheless put in such a way that it says, provided no obstacle is placed in the way, so that a human being can place the obstacle. I see not wanting to receive the sacrament, or not believing in it. There's no magic to it. I can have all the water of the Atlantic poured on me, see? And a whole nation pronouncing the words, I baptize you. If I don't believe, nothing happens. So that ex opere operato is not so operato, see, that is magic. There is still a human counterpart.
Yeah, I'll just ask two questions. One, in baptism, does the person who's administering baptism, saying the words, have to be a believer?
No.
Okay, and next, is there a difference between a monk and a priest? Would a monk's priest?
Yes, there is a difference. Sometimes a monk is a priest. Some priests are monks. But clearly, you can have people who belong to a monastic life who are not priests, and there are priests who don't belong to the monastic life. Well, the word monk, by the way, is something of a medieval term. It is not much used in modern days. We sometimes, among ourselves, speak of the monks with our tongues in our cheek, because while we belong to what is called technically a monastic life, we are not in the old 7th century sense monks. Technically, a monk is one who professes to follow the evangelical counsels of poverty, chastity, and obedience, normally lives in a community which may be called a monastery. And of course, you can have a man, say, like Saint Benedict, or better known, perhaps, Francis of Assisi. He was not exactly a monk, but he, in general, professed the same basic norms, but was not a priest. Francis of Assisi was not a priest. In the early church, most of the monks were not priests. A big monastery of 200 or 300 men, subiaco, and so on, practically nobody would be a priest there. Just enough priests to offer Mass and hear confessions. I gave a talk at Gethsemane some time ago, at the unearthly hour of 4:30 in the morning. Said my Mass at 2:30, had a light breakfast, and then spoke to the monks. They were there, bright and fresh. And I filed into the monastic hall there. The abbot was sitting on a kind of a dais, rather simple, wasn't throne exactly, just a chair raised somewhat. There was a chair next to him, which evidently was meant for me. So I filed through these monks. I met Merton before the night before, then we had a talk afterwards. And I was, of course, flattered to think that they would want to listen to an outsider, but they did. And, well, as I walked down, they all bowed. I felt terribly embarrassed. I looked just through the corner of my eye to see how many priests were there. Very few. I suppose about 10 or 15 priests. Out of a community of over 250. The rest were all monks.
Luther was a monk, not a priest.
Plus a priest. He was also a priest.
But he only had another monk's theology training.
Right, he didn't. Well, he had the monk's training. He had some theology, too. A monk takes the vows, does the work, frequently manual work, could be scholarly work. But now the brothers that are coming to teach at this new boys' high school, what is that? Is that Hackett? Hackett High School? Out in, where is it, Partington?
Gumbler Road, right at the end.
Now that will be taught by the Brothers of Mary, or called the Marianists. I don't think they use the word brothers anymore. Most of their men are not priests, and could in a loose sense be called monks.
A monk and a friar are equal to
it? No. A monk normally is one who stays put. A friar is one who goes around. That's a good general description. Monks who go around become friars. If friars stay put, they become monks. Francis got the idea, don't just wait for the people to come to you, you go to them. Yeah.
Father, please, there's something still that is fuzzy to me concerning the degrees in sanctification. Are those degrees in sanctification worked out any way through the sacraments, or am I transferring your canonization?
Could be by the sacraments. See, notice, the Reformed tradition would keep the two sacraments, say, of baptism and the Lord's Supper. They keep the prayer. They would keep various Christian practices, including the virtues. And you could, in a sense, say that it is through the sacraments that you increase in your justification. The whole question is, when you say through the sacraments, what do you mean by that preposition? See? Do they become means of grace in the sense that you somehow contribute to the ongoing sanctifying process? If you do, then to that extent you depart from pure Calvinism. So in other words, God may use, in fact you would expect him to use the sacraments. But notice, it is he using them, not you using them, and you cooperating with Christ in achieving sanctification. Shall we go on? Just one word practically on good works. By the way, I ask you to read. You see what we're doing. We're just taking big issues, controversial issues, the whole thing, these Reformed creeds. This one thing by itself deserves a whole semester's course. It's got that much. But take on page 211, chapter 16, paragraph 7. Here is one of the clearest instances in which pure Calvinism stands out. You see, if you just say it, we are sinners, we are born into sin, we can't do nothing of ourselves. Well, a person will listen and say, I guess that's right. But not be impressed by it. Not take it seriously. Not really mean that Calvin meant what he said. He meant it. Now, this paragraph, if anything should settle it, this ought to settle it. There's still a lingering doubt in anybody's mind of what the Reformed Creed means about being unjustified, about not having grace, and therefore of being capable of nothing else but sin. Here it is, should it. Works done by unregenerate men, who are they? Those that are not justified. How are they justified? By faith. Although for the matter of them, they may be things which God commands. They may even perform things which look like their virtues, and have good use both to themselves and others. They're good citizens. They don't kill people. Yet, and that yet, because they proceed not from a heart purified by faith, nor are done in the right manner, according to the word, nor to a right end, the glory of God, how could they be if they're not justified, people? They are therefore sinful. Now, what I want you to do is to connect. And once you've made this connection, this should, in one short sentence, identify Reformed theology. Works done by unregenerate men, the first phrase, and skip about six lines, are therefore sinful and cannot please God, nor make a man meet to receive grace from God. And you can add, which Calvin always added, the adjective all works done by unregenerate men. Everything which those who are not justified do are sins. Why not? Because our nature is sinful. See, it looks a little less clear. There's a bit of obscurity when you've got a person who has the grace. You're liable to suspect that maybe he's contributing something. Well, here it's clear. If he is not justified, then everything which he does is simply, sheerly, unequivocally sin. And it is this which I want you to hark back to the previous section. Namely, that all those who are not Christian, what is that? All those who are not Christian, there it is, page 206, chapter 10, paragraph 4, much less can men not professing that Christian religion be saved in any other way whatsoever. They can't be saved if they're not Christians. Why not? Clearly, they cannot be unregenerate. They've never heard of Christ. Everything they do is sin, is a sin. Now, that mentality, if I leave you with any in this course, and I hope to leave you with at least a dozen ideas, one idea I don't want you to lose is to recognize behind this stands, and it is simply history, behind this stands the attitude of the colonial world, which was mainly a reformed colonial world's attitude towards the non-Christian world. They are sinners, and that is where a Christian is saying everything. And that means Hindus, Buddhists, Confucians, Taoists, you name them. Yes, if you wish. T-A-O. And now it happens, just to insert a little item, it happens that the Reformed creeds, even as we're having the Westminster Confession, took quite some time to get this clear. I mean, it's in Calvin, all right, don't misunderstand it. But I mean, the clarity, see, these words are, you can't miss them. And the beauty is, this is originally written in English, so we're safe. You know what I mean? This is official. Another reason why I took the Westminster Confession. We're having the actual confession, not merely somebody's translation from the German or French. It's as clear as language can make it. That here, those who are unregenerate, who have not been justified, which by a prior description or definition, those who have not received Christ, of course, at the very least they, therefore all they do is sinful. It took, by the way, the genius of a French Catholic bishop by the name of Jansenius to clarify this. Jansenius, as you may know, started Jansenism. He was a Calvinist bishop of the Catholic Church. Jansenius was just as Calvin himself. In fact, a little better, because he was a bit clearer than even Calvin. He was bishop of a place called Ypres, which I'm told the GIs called Wipers. Y-P-R-E-S. Jansenius lived and died a good Catholic. But before his death, he finished a volume, a big book called Augustinus, which simply means Augustine. And in his estimation, this was the last word on Augustine. He had thoroughly imbued himself in Calvinism. He believed, and to indicate how subtle the ecumenical movement is, Jansenius's purpose was to meet the Reformed theology halfway. He crossed the Rubicon. He stepped to the other side. It is said of him that he would spend weeks without going to bed. He would sleep in a chair or kind of a desk which he had fixed up for him, reading, studying, analyzing. It is further said that he read through the writings of Augustine 10 times. Anybody reads through them once? Yes, a hero in my estimation. Well, Jansenius clarified this thing, and it is significant that much of the clarity in the Reformed Protestant tradition comes both from the writers before Jansenius, mainly a man by the name of Michael Dubai, otherwise called Bias, whose system is called Bionism. who was strongly opposed by no less a man than Bellarmine, who made himself hated by the Bionists. Anyhow, it's a long, complex story. We don't go into it here. But the clarity we have in the Reformed creeds is partly due to the conflict with Catholic theology trying to make sense of this and trying to find how can we reconcile this with our own thinking. Well, there's some that's reconciled it so completely that they became Calvinists, which is just another name for Jansenism. Jansenism equals Catholic Calvinism. That's all. I want to give you some background as to why this thing is so clear. It is very clear. Now, in the Reformed Creed, there's one section I want to spend a bit of time on, and I think without apologies, because honestly, the things that we still have to cover will be made more clear if we can syncopate them, because we've taken the basic creeds with greater thoroughness. Under the section dealing with the religious worship and the Sabbath, then the relationship of the church and state, and marriage and divorce. Three things we want to cover in class today before we tackle the 39 articles. This is 16 to 217, 218, 16 to 18. And specifically, to give you the numbers if you want to, paragraphs 2, 4, 6, 7. In chapter 21. Excellent. Living, or that shall live hereafter, but not for the dead. Nor for those, but this is unusual, nor for those of whom it may be known that they have sinned the sin unto death, those who are unrepentant. If they have died, rather, pardon me, if they have despaired, even though they're still living, don't pray for them. They have the mark of Cain on them. They are lost before they die. So why bother? Why waste your breath?
These people that sin unto death, I don't really quite understand it in the framework of elect. Because wouldn't this be speaking of anyone who's not elect?
Yeah.
And you're naturally not going to pray for anyone who's elect because it wouldn't do any good.
Right. And you know that a person is not elect if, say, he has sinned the sin unto death, if he has indicated his despair of, say, God's mercy. So why bother? He is surely not one of the predestined.
Why pray for the predestined?
Why pray for the predestined? You never pray for anybody. We just pray to God to manifest his mercy towards you. It illustrates, it shows, it signifies, it symbolizes, it is a sign of all kinds of synonyms of God's love for you, of his mercy.
The fact that you pray.
Right.
But your prayer itself doesn't do anything at all.
Correct. There's nothing, in other words, there's no hypothesis, see, in Reformed theology. See, there's no hypothesis that if you didn't pray, then you wouldn't get. Or if you pray, you will get. And that's probably a simple way of describing it. See, there's just no hypothesis. Because there's nothing on which God depends.
Well, prayer can do nothing anyway, because it's all set.
And you're anticipating. You mean, absolutely speaking, apart from the Calvinist tradition?
No, I mean, in Calvinism.
Of course.
And you couldn't change God's mind then.
No.
God.
So you don't pray in the sense, in other words, all prayer, this is another way of putting it, as you find in men like Barth, all prayer is glorifying God. All prayer is adoring God. All prayer is praising God. No prayer ever really asks God. Okay? As though on your petition rests, again, the hypothesis of your getting if you pray, not getting if you don't. Okay? Don't suspect there's no chink in this armor. Okay? There's no chink. Right? Now another, from another slightly different angle, in paragraph 6. Neither prayer nor any other part of religious worship is now under the gospel, either tied unto or made more acceptable by any place in which it is performed, or toward which it is directed, such as, say, shrines or churches or places of worship. Again, if there is no hypothesis in God's mercy to begin with, much less would there be a greater or less efficacy because you say pray in church instead of praying outside of church. There is nothing unconditioned. Everything is absolutely set. Right now in chapter or verse, seven. It's interesting to note that in the Reformed tradition, it is recognized that since the resurrection of Christ, Sunday has been changed from the old Jewish Sabbath to be called the Lord's Day. But one thing which, however, bears some emphasis is the fact that the word Sabbath, which, as you know, means rest in Hebrew, is still quite strong. In fact, as you know, has found its way in, say, the Blue Laws that we've got even in the United States. The Quakers, who come from this tradition, and many others. The association of Sunday, which is, of course, transferred as far as day goes, from the 7th to the 1st, the association of that with rest, that is much more typically a Protestant concept than a Catholic one. Not to say that servile work as such is not forbidden in a Catholic teaching. Nevertheless, you don't find that mighty extreme emphasis that you find in certain types, and especially in the Reformed tradition of Protestantism, of complete abstention from any kind, even of enjoyment or recreation on Sunday. In Geneva, for example, this is simply a fact. A man, if he were known to have kissed his wife on Sunday, he was liable to a minor, but nevertheless a penalty. I suppose because he enjoyed doing so. Chapter 23 of the Civil Magistrates. In that, paragraph 3 should be blazoned on the portals of all courts of American law, which should be required reading in all courses of political science. Just a bit of background before we read the text. As you know, our American laws, as they are now, derive from the English law as it has been filtered through close to 200 years, better than 200 years, in fact, of English history. Part of which English history, remember, this is 1646, which is still mighty early as far as American colonial times go. Meaning, therefore, that by the time of our own constitutions being framed, what was the Constitutional Congress first? Was it 1779, was it? 89. At any rate, by the end of the 18th century, you've got over 200 years of legal history. Now, American legal history, as found in the Constitution and as worked out in our basic laws, and we are just now unwinding the implications of those laws. Remember, less time has passed since the first Constitutional Congress, that's correct, than had passed from, say, the beginnings of the Reformation to the Revolutionary War. See, there have been over 250 years almost of Reformation history prior to our nation being born. That's a long history. And that history, remember, as you'll find out in a few, maybe not so few minutes, when we come into the English Reformation, which is in the middle of the 16th century, is Protestant history. Now, that Protestant history is so closely entwined with the identification, and the word is not too strong, of the civil magistracy and the teachings of Christ or the teachings of the church, that for an American it is, some say it's impossible. Having studied in Europe, having lived and talked to people and constantly in correspondence with people from other countries. And on many times we've discussed this. Men specialists teaching law a whole lifetime in European universities. They know American legal history. They wonder whether we can ever get out of it, whether we ever will graduate from the identification of the civil authority with the church, religious ideas, religious principles. To conceive of two distinct societies, they say, is so un-American that they believe we have to revamp our nation to get away from it. What's happening, of course, there is a dichotomy being established. The tragedy, this is an insert, and my own commentary. The tragedy is the dichotomy is being done not by believers, but by unbelievers. Where they're trying to dichotomize something which has been built into American philosophy, see? In which a lot of people, and not only unbelievers, think needs undichotomizing. But that's a long political question. However, we want to get a theology. Let's read the paragraph. The civil magistrate may not assume to himself the administration of the word and sacraments or the power of the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Well, all right. He may not preach. He may not administer the sacraments. And he may not have or does not have authority in purely spiritual things. Yet. What's the yes, by the way, in the Reformed Confessions? They're deceptively simple. Yet. And much more belongs to the yet. He has authority. And by the way, when the Reformed speak of authority, they mean authority. Which means juridical power of demanding obedience just because you declare it. And the voluntarism which they attribute to God, watch this, the voluntarism which they attribute to God, they never lose sight of when it comes to the magistrate. No less than God has to explain himself, does the magistrate, as the vice chairman of God, have to explain himself. He passes the law and you obey. He hath authority. And it is his duty, not merely a prerogative or a privilege, to take order. In other words, to take over. That's. He's got a lot of authority. That unity and peace be preserved in the church, mind you. Not in the state of the church. That the truth of God be kept pure and entire. The civil magistrate. To decide that the truth of God be kept pure and entire. Who is judge of what is pure and entire? The civil magistrate. That all blasphemies and heresies be suppressed. What's heresy? Anything deviating from the Reformed Creed. All corruptions and abuse in worship and discipline. Prevented or reformed. These are all universals. All. And all the ordinances of God duly settled. Administered and observed. What more can you give? Still more. For the better effecting whereof, he hath power to call synods, he can organize the church, to be present at them, and to provide that whatsoever is transacted in them be according to the mind of God. And the next paragraph, of course, just a simple correlative. And it's the duty of the people to listen. The chapter 23. Paragraph 3 describes in ovo, which is a Latin word for in egg, in seed. In ovo, it describes the juridical background of the American juridical system. Now, let's break this up a little bit because it has too many implications, and we can't go into them here. Behind it, of course, stands first a realism which was over 100 years in the making. At first it was not so. Now Calvin was much more careful, he was much more cautious about giving this kind of authority to the civil magistrate. And Luther simply distrusted, although he used, in many ways he used civil authority, yet he would never spell it out in such detail. about 100 and more years of history have proved, especially in the Reformed tradition, that where you have, as had been done, removed ecclesiastical authority to make sure that people behave themselves, and that's the basic reason for having any kind of authority in a society, people conform to the norms of that society, things were getting out of hand. In other words, much had been learned about human nature. This was, if you will, a compromise, and really a death and life and death compromise, to have society survive. And recognizing the need for authority, there was only one option. It was impossible to make the choice of saying there is no visible authority. The only question is, who has it? It would either have been a return to that whence they came, or use the existing civil structure and give it what for 1,500 years the church had resisted unto blood, not to give it. For fear of the state taking over. This was not a taking over. This was given to him. Now, this paragraph can be spelled out in all directions. Because, as we'll see, we'll come to the next chapter on marriage and divorce, which is family life, but education, social welfare. Studies, for example, if you've ever read Pastor's Lives of the Popes, Ludwig von Pastor, 40 volume, no less, in heavy German, which is, I think they finished the translation of the 40 volumes, took years. And he goes to the early Middle Ages, 11th, 12th, 13th centuries. There were social welfare, there were hospitals, there were hostels, there were orphanages and so on. But they were all under the aegis of the church. And in fact, even loan associations, the Monte di Pietà in Italy, all kinds of, where you would put your money in, and you could take money out. But once of course, this is not only with the Reformation, it had been built up to. In fact, part of the build-up was the pressure being exerted by the civil authority, and the pressure was stronger and stronger, began way back in the early 13th century, 14th, 15th, 16th century, over 300 years of pressure from civil authority. Well, by the middle of the 17th century, that pressure was off. In other words, by that time, it had become theologized to the point where the civil authority of the state was no longer considered as some kind of an encroacher on the rights of the church. It belonged by right to the civil authority to direct even matters which were strictly ecclesiastical. This is partly colored, as we will see, by the English tradition. However, its roots really are in the Reformation itself, particularly as Calvin and his followers understood. Somebody had a question, right?
Yeah. You gave a bifurcation of ends that they could have reached, either going back to the Catholicism structure of authority or that which they chose to make the civil structure of authority. Wasn't there a third alternative being the free church system? Had the free church system ever reached a crisis point like this and chose the free church system over authority of the Pope or authority of the state?
Well, by free church system, as I think you mean, or historically it does mean, Congregationalism. Well, all it does is, you might say, sort of palliate the condition. Because just because you have, say, 30 or 40 pockets of authority doesn't really in any way unify even a given municipality. In other words, the free church system would work, that is, to allow it its due, it would or could work if each congregation were also a civil community. If we belong to a given church, all form their own little village. In fact, that's the way it worked. They often did it. They just couldn't stand it anymore. They'd go and form another village. That's how many of our villages started, by the way. But as society multiplied and became more complex, and especially in larger communities, and of course this was being written originally for England and Scotland, right, where there were big communities, the free church system wouldn't work. Besides, a lot of people were not sympathetic with it. What are you going to do with them? They've got to be under authority too. No, marriage and divorce.
Was this a purely pragmatic thing, or is there a theological justification?
Also theological. Also theological. The pragmatism, of course, we can briefly explain and much more can be put into it. It is also theological in the sense that, on the premise that the church is basically, as we said before, composed, or maybe we didn't say it here, I keep mixing my two classes, that the church was fundamentally an invisible society, in essence. And for the Reformed tradition, it would be basically those who are predestined. They belong to the church. Well, who knows who is predestined? Nobody but God. And therefore, there is really no provision, according to this theology, for any kind of a visible organization to begin with, let alone an authority. So in other words, it is really an implicit denial that there is visible authority in the church. And since people have got to, well, behave themselves and being what they are, in other words, behind it is the implication that there is such a mixture or conglomeration of the predestined and the unpredestined in the world that somebody must make sure that the unpredestined, the unregenerate, okay, don't make life unlivable for the predestined. That's one way of putting it. And that is the function of the state. And of course, there are some wonderful passages in St. Paul on the authority of the state. Another theological reason, or reasoning at least, is in the Old Testament. Where, as you know, the civil ruler, a man like David, was also the ruler of the people as a prophet.
Is Calvin's idea then obedience to the state? It seems to me almost blind obedience. But there must be some.
In fact, pardon me, there would never have been a James the Sixth of Scotland except in the Reformed tradition. Is he the same as James the First of England? A divine right of kings. Divine right of kings, all he had to do is quote the Westminster Confession. I'm not sure about what are his dates. Who knows the exact dates? When did he die? 1603. Well, the tradition at least is here. He anticipated, pardon me, he came before. The point is, it is the same basic traditions.
Is this
is the middle of the 17th century. But it goes all the way back to Geneva, actually, and the middle of the 16th century. Why, no, on marriage and divorce. The significant passage or passages are the two paragraphs, 5 and 6, under what conditions a person may get a divorce and the right to remarry. Now, it is significant that the rights of the civil magistrate come before the crucial subject.